Welcome to Teleforum, a podcast of the Federalist Society's practice groups. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President, General Counsel, and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of practice group Teleforum calls, become a Federalist Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's Teleforum conference call. This afternoon, February 24th, we discuss today's Supreme Court oral argument in Lange v. California. My name is Evelyn Hildebrand, and I'm the Associate Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Today, we are fortunate to have with us Larry James, Clark Neely, and Vikrant Reddy. Mr. Larry James is a managing partner at Crabb, Brown, and James LLP. He is a life member of the Sixth Circuit Judicial Conference and has served as general counsel for the National Fraternal Order of Police since 2001. Mr. Clark Neely is vice president for criminal justice at the Cato Institute. He is also an adjunct professor of law at the University of Texas School of Law, and he served as co-counsel in the landmark Supreme Court case, District of Columbia versus Teller. Mr. Vikrant Reddy is a senior research fellow at the Charles Koch Institute. He previously served as a senior policy analyst at the Texas Public Policy Foundation, where he managed the launch of the foundation's National Right on Crime Initiative. We are very pleased to have these experts on our call today. After our speakers give their opening remarks, we will turn to you, the audience, for questions. So be thinking of those as we go along and have them in mind for when we get to that portion of the call. With that, thank you for being with us today. Vikrant, the floor is yours.
Thanks so much, Evelyn. I just want to thank you and the entire Federalist Society for inviting me to do this today. It's such an incredibly interesting case, and it starts with really deceptively simple facts. Mr. Lange is driving through Sonoma, California. He's having a great time, as I suppose one does when one visits Sonoma, California, although he lives there, and he's driving his car, and the windows are down, he's blasting his music, he's honking for no reason, really, and just behaving somewhat erratically. He's driving this way as he drives past a police officer. The officer follows his car. He starts, he continues driving, and he drives to his home in Sonoma. He pulls into the driveway, and as he's pulling up to his home, the officer's lights start flashing. Mr. Lange doesn't see the lights flashing. He pulls into his home and, in fact, pulls into his garage. The police officer steps out of the car, walks over to the garage, and as the garage door is coming down, he puts his foot underneath the garage door so that it triggers the sensor, and the garage door goes right back up. Police officer can smell alcohol inside the garage. He goes in, and sure enough, it'll be no surprise to anybody on the call that Mr. Lange is drunk. He's extremely drunk. He's three times over the legal limit. And he ends up being charged with DUI and also with some kind of a noise infraction. So Mr. Lange goes to court, and he argues that the evidence that was collected inside the garage ought to be excluded, because police officers generally cannot enter your home without a warrant. This police officer clearly entered the home without a warrant. The court disagreed with Mr. Lange, and they said, yeah, that's the general rule. You can't go in without a warrant, but there are exceptions. And being in hot pursuit of someone is a clear exception. If you are chasing somebody, they seem to be evading arrest, they can't just escape into their home and get away from law enforcement. It doesn't work that way. This case is, went up to the Supreme Court today, where we heard oral arguments. Interestingly, Mr. Lange defended his position, but the state of California didn't actually defend the position of their state court. I'm not entirely sure why that was, but my hunch is that that had to do with politics and the fact that it would have not been tenable in California's political culture for the state to be defending that court's decision, which seemed to be anti-privacy and pro-law enforcement, et cetera, et cetera. But the amicus who was appointed, a former Kagan clerk, to argue the lower court's decision or to defend the lower court's decision, I thought did a great job. I also thought that Mr. Lange's attorney, Jeff Fisher from Stanford Law School, did a great job. It's a tough case. It's going to be a narrow call, most likely in the end. And there were a whole lot of people who are interested in how to think about this question of what constitutes a hot pursuit and principally whether or not you should fundamentally draw a distinction between felonies and misdemeanors. Whether or not, well, it's okay if it's you're in hot pursuit of somebody who's committed a felony, but perhaps less okay to have an aggressive policing tactic when you're in hot pursuit of somebody who has committed a misdemeanor. And a lot of the argument today focused on that question. And a lot of justices just found that kind of distinction to be, maybe understandable in an old kind of common sense instinctive way, but completely unworkable as a matter of practical reality these days. Justice Gorsuch pointed out that, look, just about everybody has committed a felony. Everything is criminalized these days. Justice Kagan pointed out that, look, you have cases where something like domestic violence, which is very serious and violent, is a misdemeanor, but something like white-collar crime, which is not at all violent, is a felony. This kind of felony-misdemeanor distinction doesn't work. This isn't the right kind of lens to apply here. That was a big part of the tenor of the argument. But the bottom line was that they're going to have to figure out how to handle this felony misdemeanor hot pursuit question. And it was an absolutely fascinating case. But those are the basics of it. And I think now I'll turn to Clark Neely from the Cato Institute to give his thoughts on how the argument went and perhaps who had the better of it.
Well, thanks, Vikrant. This is Clark Neely from the Cato Institute. I want to thank you and Larry and Evelyn and all our friends of the Federal Society. This is a really fascinating case. It's a challenging case. And I what I see in this case is kind of a collision of a number of different values or dynamics that make it an especially difficult case, I think, to decide. First, we've got the point that you and Justice Gorsuch and others have alluded to, which is the complete trivialization of the concept of crime. It's not just felonies that have been trivialized. Misdemeanors are trivialized as well. I can go out into my neighborhood in suburban North Arlington and observe dozens of misdemeanors. I myself have committed a number of misdemeanors. I won't elaborate, but I have. And I will tell you that, for example, it's a tradition in the cul-de-sac where I live for parents to come out on Halloween with their children with an adult beverage in their hand as they walk around with the kids trick-or-treating. Every single one of those parents has committed a misdemeanor under Virginia law. And so we've utterly trivialized the concept of crime, and many of us just go out sort of going about our daily lives. We commit crimes for which we could be arrested regularly and without really thinking too much about it. So that's the first point, is the extent to which we've utterly trivialized the concept of crime. Then second, we've got the justices' very legitimate concern about the deliberate resistance to the authority of law enforcement. It's unclear whether that happened in this case, and Justice Alito repeatedly questioned the different advocates about whether this really was someone trying to evade a hot pursuit. He kept alluding to the video, and his impression was that Mr. Lang didn't even know that the officer was trying to pull him over. But I think it's reasonable to suppose that in the majority of cases, there will be, in fact, a conscious effort to resist the authority of a police officer who's trying to make a stop or perhaps also an arrest for a misdemeanor, and that's concerning. Third, of course, we have the sanctity of the home. The Supreme Court has held repeatedly that for Fourth Amendment purposes, the home is a particularly sensitive and highly protected environment, and we do not typically lightly allow the government to intrude into somebody's home, and the requirement that law enforcement generally obtain a warrant before penetrating into the home is a very clear and important value in American constitutional law and common law. And then fourth, and I think this is relatively new, and it's not entirely clear to me that the justices have updated their perspective on this point yet, is I think the increasingly legitimate fear that people have about interacting with members of law enforcement. And unfortunately, we can see video after video and incident after incident. Recently, there was a 9-year-old girl who was pepper sprayed by police in Rochester, New York. Same department asphyxiated a man by kneeling on him for 15 minutes, somewhat reminiscent of the George Floyd incident that happened to a man in Dallas, Texas, Tony Timpa. Called police for help when they arrived. He was having a mental health issue. They kneeled on him for 15 minutes until he was dead. So to to minimize or dismiss the very real concerns that people have about interacting with police, I think, is untenable in the current environment. The question, I think, is how does all of this shake out? So we've got a situation where at least some people will have legitimate reasons for not wanting to interact with a police officer, even if they know that they're being pursued. Sometimes they won't know they're being pursued. What do we make of that? They have managed to reach a place of extraordinarily important constitutional significance, their home, which the Supreme Court has not always consistently, but has generally been quite protective of. And once they have reached that home, does this additional constitutional protection kick in where the officer cannot enter without a warrant? And these are not easy values to resolve. The last point I want to make is this. I think it's also the case that rather clearly in some of these instances, the pursuit itself is merely the prelude to a fishing expedition. There's really nothing. Society has nothing particularly at stake about a man driving down the street, honking his horn and playing loud music. I don't know for a fact that that was what was going on in this case, but there will be cases where what's really going on here is simply that the officer wants to extend or wants to make contact and extend that contact however long is necessary to develop an investigation and see if there's something actually meaningful that they can make an arrest for. I think part of what may be driving this is that it seems clear to me anyway that in this particular instance, if there were a warrant requirement, in other words, if this officer had been required to get a warrant after Mr. Lang managed to get inside his garage and begin shutting the garage door, can anybody really imagine this police officer going to the trouble of getting a warrant and having to explain to a judge that the only thing that he has observed is somebody playing loud music and honking their horn while driving the car? I suspect the judge is going to say, don't waste my time. You can see the law enforcement officer who wants to extend an investigation, who wants to be able to question somebody. Maybe they want to be able to get close enough to smell their breath or smell the interior of their car. They have strong reasons why they might want to avoid a warrant requirement and be able to, on their own initiative, conduct a non-consensual investigation, which is ultimately what happened here. I don't know how all these values shake out, but I think it's clear that the justices were aware of at least some of them. But I am personally somewhat concerned about whether they were aware and demonstrated enough concern about all of them, particularly the concern that an increasing number of people have about their personal safety when interacting with members of law enforcement.
Larry James, I think the court's going to sustain the decision of the California court. I think the question that the court was struggling with is, should it hand down a blanket rule that goes nationally? The court clearly stated that each state, looking at Massachusetts versus California, have very different guidelines as to what is a misdemeanor versus a felony. The one thing I would take issue with, I think the court was very clear that they thought the law enforcement community had common sense and good judgment. The officer in this case was a 7-year veteran who we would assume has the ability to look at when drivers are driving erratically or dangerous or giving off signals that something might be wrong. So I would say it would be the equivalent of a Terry stop, and I think we'll all agree that officers on their own reasonable suspicion have the ability to inquire of a driver or a citizen if they are concerned. I think the court said that, and I think they will hold this, that it doesn't make a lot of difference to this court when we're talking about is it a felony or a misdemeanor offense. And the reason is the states around the country are all over the place. So in our instance, was the individual a drunk driver? Did the officer believe that? Did the officer believe that that individual was a potential danger? Did he believe that maybe there were some drugs or any number of things? And he had the right to make that inquiry. I think the other thing is when you are in pursuit or hot pursuit, however you want to call it, and the officer gives a signal and turns on his lights and or siren, should the public be required to obey that? I think we make a distinct difference between those crimes that were referred to as in neighborhoods during a block party, someone walks out with an open container, or you have children playing in the park and then they disperse and they do nothing. So I think the court's going to come down and say that they will not make a distinction and force law enforcement to try to determine whether a felony or the degree of the crime. I think the court seemed to suggest that if it required jail time of X number of months or a year, then it's clearly inclined to go along with the California ruling, where the officer had justifiable reason to pursue the individual and to go into the home without a warrant. When we look at the statistics of drivers who are uninsured or who may be driving intoxicated, I think those are the sort of things I think the court, although it didn't spend a lot of time talking about, is going to come down to. I think the court also talked about trying to make a distinction through its question is whether if you have an individual who was in custody who has escaped versus an individual who's fleeing. And I don't think the court's going to make a big distinction. It is clear, I think, from the case law, if an individual is escaping, that law enforcement official has the ability to follow that individual and go into the home. I think the court's cognizant of the fact that, you know, traditionally a home is a person's castle. But I think if it's these emergency exceptions, I think the court's going to allow that officer to have a warrantless invasion. It's not going to try to determine whether the officer has to make a constitutional determination. Is it the degree of misdemeanor or is it a felony? And I think that is an impossible imposition to place on law enforcement officers. So although the court, the way the argument went, the court, Justice Roberts started out asking his questions, and then each justice, and I don't think one justice passed. I think there was a clear indication that they were siding with the officers in this area. And I think that's the way the case is going to come down. The big question, I think, the push was, should the court say it's an absolute right for law enforcement to have the right to pursue a misdemeanor violation and also make that a warrantless search if that's the case? And I think it may make that distinction, but I think it's going to uphold the lower court. Thank you. And I'd like to thank you all for inviting the National FOP to be a part of this discussion. So, thanks.
Hey, Evelyn. This is a...
Yes, would you like to take audience?
Yeah, well, actually, before we jump to audience questions, I want to just raise a few thoughts that I have about some policy issues that I think come out of this case. They're not directly connected to the central question of the case, but I think they're kind of peripheral and they're fascinating. You know, the main thing that we discussed, I think, is this question of overcriminalization and the number of crimes that are on the books and the ways in which officers are expected to address all of them. And I wonder, there's a big national conversation happening right now about whether or not we're simply asking officers to do too much, right? They have to respond to traffic incidents. They have to respond to mental health crises. They have to respond to you know, drug abuse problems. And of course, we still want them to respond to very serious violent crimes, which is their primary role. There are a lot of people out there thinking about ways to what sometimes people call unbundle these functions of the police and find other people in society who can handle certain tasks so that not every single one of these problems is handled by an armed agent of the state. Because that is causing, I think, a lot of intimidation and mistrust. And Clark spoke a lot about this also, but the fact that there are just certain people in the country who are they're frightened whenever they see police officers approaching. It doesn't necessarily mean that they've done anything wrong, but they just have this profound mistrust, and it's affecting these police-civilian relationships. There were some interesting moments in the arguments today where some justices, like I think Justice Roberts said, look, the moment somebody is running from the police, they become quite suspicious. You start saying to yourself, well, what does this person have to hide? And Mr. Fisher, who is representing Mr. Lange, said, well, you know, you can have people who are teenagers who are close to home and feel, oh, gosh, I don't want to have a conversation with police officers unless mom or dad are around and they try to get home. You can have women who have heard stories, read stories, know people who have been sexually assaulted by a police officer. Maybe it's late at night and they worry about what could happen to them and they just want to get back home. And of course, the biggest question over all of this is the question of some minority populations, minority communities, who might say, you know, I've just seen too much in the news. I'm worried. I just want to get home. I don't want to have this adversarial interaction with a member of law enforcement. So to the extent that we can maybe unbundle some police functions, I think it could help to rebuild trust and confidence in law enforcement. I think it could be helpful. The final thing I want to note, this is a little bit idiosyncratic, but I just thought it was fascinating, and I want to point it out, is that there were a number of amicus briefs filed in support of Mr. Lange, and you could probably guess that they came from civil libertarian-oriented organizations. The Institute for Justice filed one, the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers, the ACLU. But I also thought it was so interesting that the Gun Owners of America filed one. And I think that's something I'm starting to see more and more in the criminal justice reform space, that people who are concerned with Second Amendment rights are increasingly concerned with criminal justice reform. And, you know, you saw an interesting example of that here. You see it from time to time when there are laws that deny Second Amendment rights to certain classes of felons, and gun owners are coming forward and saying, well, you know, this is in the Bill of Rights. We better be careful about denying these rights to people, just like we're careful about denying First Amendment rights, you know, to people who've been convicted of crimes. It's a really interesting nexus that's emerging, and I just think one that's worth keeping our eyes on.
This is Larry. I think that may very well be true, but that is not just the case. I think the thing that probably is going to guide us in this case more than anything else, across the nation, we have 20% of the police departments that restrict pursuit to felony offenses, and then another 50% allow for misdemeanor pursuits. And then you have your state laws that are going to govern in some instances. But I think this is a pretty straightforward case. I think the difficulty for the court is, can it lay down a blanket policy that makes sense? And I think it's probably going to hesitate on that and side more with the reasoning that came out of California. And I'll stop there.
Ms. Clark, I don't have much more to say or to add. Again, I will emphasize, I think this is a challenging case. I personally think that the time has come for the justices to somewhat update their perspectives, as I suggested in my initial remarks. I suspect that many of them are, to some extent, their worldview is colored by their own interactions, perhaps, or their own lack of interactions with law enforcement. I don't say that they are unaware that other people have different experiences, but a number of other doctrines that are in play right now, including particularly the qualified immunity doctrine, which is the one that provides government officials, including particularly police, with a defense to civil rights actions if the conduct at issue or the wrongfulness of the conduct was not clearly established. My overall impression of the court is that it sort of remains bound in a somewhat old-fashioned view of the fundamental essence of the relationship between citizens and law enforcement that really no longer accurately reflects the perception and the feelings of a very significant, and I would say growing chunk of Americans. And I think the longer it takes the court to update its understanding, its awareness on those fronts, the greater the tension is going to become, both doctrinally and in terms of people's confidence in law enforcement as an institution.
I think if I were, just from a practical standpoint, I think the court was also concerned with an individual who's fleeing from a police officer, for that individual to retreat in his or her home and at the same time potentially destroy evidence, you know, whether that be drugs or whether, you know, one of the arguments was that the officer could go and knock on the door. And I think the justices uniformly agreed that that is not practical and will not work. It also talked about the difficulty of securing a warrant in a reasonable time in order to pursue this. I just think that the question, and I think we'll all agree, I did not hear one justice that was in fact troubled by the sustaining of the conviction. I think what the justices are wrestling with and will wrestle with is whether they can articulate a policy and bridge these concerns on this case. And I think they will try to be narrow on that.
It might be time to take some questions.
You know, for those who did not listen to the argument, it is now up, and I agree that, you know, there is, you know, hopefully I don't know if the quality of the recording is going to be helpful, but I think listening to it, and I think it went, what, about an hour and 45 minutes?
Yeah.
It was an hour and 45 minutes that the justices, without exception, each one questioned each advocate that came before the court.
Yeah, I'll say that if the audio that was posted is as bad as the audio that Clark and Larry and I heard, he may just want to go to the transcript instead.
Correct.
Are we ready to take some audience questions, or perhaps yes. You have more things to discuss among yourselves?
Questions would be good.
All right, great. We'll now go to audience questions. So we will now move to our first caller.
This is Christopher Melling, and I'm a 2L here at BYU, and I'm going through a criminal procedure class right now. And I apologize, I can't remember who said it, but the comment about 50 states plus DC with different circumstances and just the state of the exceptions and how complicated it is, I just strongly feel and I agree that this is an issue when you're looking at just felony versus misdemeanor in hot pursuit that should be left to the state legislatures. Is the court, I mean, I didn't get a chance to listen to argument. Is the court, is that a valid concern for the court that they're perhaps with the current makeup now that we have that more of that concern that some of these issues should be left to the states? Do you think that's part of this case specifically?
This is Larry. They did not talk about leaving it to the legislature. What they did acknowledge is just the different criteria. And they really harped on between Massachusetts, which had some misdemeanors in jail time, domestic and other type of crimes that would put someone in jail for 2 years. In California, some of the same would have de minimis jail time. And so the debate was, should the criteria be if it was a crime that led to incarceration and you had hot pursuit and warrantless search? I think I stated that right. You want to help me out, Clark?
Yeah, I mean, so I think one thing to clarify is that Mr. Lang's counsel in this case did not take the position that a hot pursuit of a suspected felon would represent a categorical exception to the warrant requirement. What they, you know, their touchstone was really more seriousness of the offense, and their position was that it's not so much a sort of a matter of formalism or terminology in terms of you know, how a state has chosen to label the conduct at issue, but really the seriousness of the conduct as one factor one potential factor among many. But their position, as I understand it, was that this is best considered under the rubric of exigency. And then the question is, does the, you know, the fact that the person is suspected of having engaged in particular conduct, you know, represent a sufficiently exigent circumstance to represent an exception to the warrant requirement? I find myself sympathetic to that approach, perhaps not surprisingly. I certainly understand that it may place an additional burden on law enforcement officers, but I thought that Mr. Fisher, Mr. Lang's counsel, made an effective response to that by saying that police in many jurisdictions, including California, have to make those kinds of distinctions as a regular part of their job. And I will harken back to something I said in my initial remarks, which is that the part of the problem here, of course, is that state legislatures have, and not just state legislatures, but also the federal government, have utterly trivialized the concept of felony. So point one, they've trivialized the concept of crime to begin with, so that all kinds of perfectly harmless activity has been denominated criminal. Justice Breyer got really obsessed with an example that I guess is a real example from California, where apparently it's a misdemeanor to give somebody a rabbit as a prize for some kind of contest. But we could multiply the examples endlessly. So, you know, I'll sum it up by saying that when you have a country like ours that has utterly trivialized the concept of crime in general and the concept of what constitutes a felony in particular, the idea of essentially allowing the legislature to effectively legislate away any meaningful content for the Fourth Amendment simply by slapping a label of felony on relatively harmless conduct, I think is both problematic and not something that's going to be an easy sell to the Supreme Court. I don't think that's likely to be the basis for their decision. I think it's going to be significantly more nuanced than that.
Did that answer your question or help you at all?
It does. Yes. The court for a while, the Fourth Amendment, and I recognize the home. I mean, the fact that it was in the garage of a home just makes it more of a Fourth Amendment issue. So I see why the court took this case likely. And the little faith in the state legislatures plays well. So thank you.
I think the other thing, the court really pressed on that distinction of trying to impose on law enforcement to make a distinction on the underlying crime. I think they will stay away from that. I think they're not going to impose that on law enforcement. I think the decision will more likely say if it's a observation and a reasonable objective standard that the police officer has that a crime may be committed and then the individual flees and is pursued, then the right to a warrantless search will more than likely be upheld. And the question is, do we continue on a case-by-case basis? The answer is yes, but I think there will be a general proposition handed down by the court.
Wonderful, thank you. And while we're waiting for other callers to join the queue and ask a question, I did want to ask our panelists, do you know of other cases that are in the pipeline or other collateral consequences that might result from the decision that the court makes today?
You know, I think that one of the observations I have on this subject is, you know, you have the veteran seasoned police officer. Usually these cases are going to be in the municipal court. The practical reality, if a lawyer files a motion to not accept evidence or prohibit its introduction or to dismiss for fruit of a poisonous tree or something like that, I think that the municipal courts are pretty good at that. I know in our jurisdictions, that would be one of the first things that are argued. I think prosecutors on the same vein are going to, unless they're being overly zealous, are going to make sure that there is a rational, reasonable, objective standard by which the police officers are going by. And, you know, they did talk about the situation of it being a crime for someone being given a rabbit. I think the court's going to look at those situations as absurd. And I don't think that under those circumstances, it's ever going to pass muster. So, you know, I think the court is really wrestling with trying to hand down a policy. I don't think these other issues, although they came into discussion, are going to carry today.
You know, when you ask about other possible consequences, maybe I'm getting, maybe I'm being overdramatic with this speculation, but I spent a lot of the past year, and I know Clark did too, thinking a lot about overcriminalization as it connected to pandemic safety measures. You know, I'm very supportive of things like mask wearing and other kinds of measures to make sure that we do what we can to, you know, protect public health and public safety. But I've always been skeptical of putting those things into our criminal law. And, you know, I think that a case like today's and the sorts of debates that were had on the court today, they kind of shed a light on why we should be careful about those kinds of things. I don't want to be in a situation where we say it's okay for police officers to enter a home when they're in hot pursuit of somebody who has committed a misdemeanor, because if that misdemeanor is something like violating a pandemic-related curfew or being suspected of not wearing your mask whenever you're out in a public place, you know, this just seems to me to be a very dangerous road to head down. And like I said, maybe I'm being overdramatic, but I don't know. People get really understandably concerned about taking the public safety and public health measures seriously, and they want police officers to do something about it. And it's a dangerous road. You you deputize police officers to enforce laws. You better make sure that that the things you make laws really need to be criminal laws.
This is Larry. I would respond and say on all of those related issues, those are ticket writing issues. Those are not arrest issues. If the extreme were to happen that an officer walks up there, you know, write a ticket and an individual runs off, as you see today in speeding tickets or things of that sort, I don't think there's a floodgates going to open on that. I think the case is pretty straightforward. I think lawyers who defend individuals know how to file motions to quash, motions to limit, motions to dismiss. The question asked earlier, are there a lot of these cases in the pipeline? That argument did not come up. It wasn't a groundswell or an argument that law enforcement is abusing that privilege. So I just don't see that, and I think it is a bit over-dramatization of that.
This is Clark Neely from Cato. I'll just jump in really quickly. I mean, one of the briefs in the case was submitted by the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers, and it has a very shocking recitation of incidents that started very small. I mean, something as ridiculous as somebody just, you know, urinating on the corner of the patio of his girlfriend's apartment. That case escalated into very nearly a gunfight inside her apartment as a plainclothes officer pursued him inside the apartment. People didn't know who was doing what. Why is this person here who's not wearing a uniform? I believe the girlfriend drew a pistol from her purse, and it was only through a miracle that no lives were lost. The truth of the matter is that happens, and it doesn't just happen sporadically. Again, the more we over-criminalize, the more we trivialize the concept of crime, the more we put police officers in a position where they have to make a decision. Do they turn a blind eye, or do they just enforce all the laws even-handedly? People are going to run away from police from time to time, or they are going to resist orders to stop and come and talk to the police. Sometimes they'll do so for motives that we would not sympathize with, and other times they'll do so for motives that we absolutely sympathize with. The thing to be aware of, unfortunately, and most of us are already aware of this if you've been reading the news at all for the past year, is how quickly these situations can get out of hand, and particularly when people who do not belong there enter someone's home by force, without having to knock and announce themselves as members of law enforcement, but just to come barging in. Things can get very, very tragic very, very quickly when we allow people who do not truly belong inside a home to enter of their own volition. It has happened before in the past, and it will certainly happen again in the future. And as I suggested during some earlier remarks, my concern is that the members of the Supreme Court do not seem to have sufficiently updated their perspectives both about the propensity for those kinds of tragedies, and also, frankly, the fact that in this day and age, there can be perfectly legitimate reasons for people to try to evade members of law enforcement, even when they understand that the person is trying to make an arrest and perhaps even do so lawfully. Maybe 50 years ago, it was very difficult to imagine somebody running from a police officer for any sort of a valid reason. Now, I think it is entirely plausible to imagine people doing that, at least in some situations.
This is Larry. I would agree there are some policy considerations. I think representing law enforcement all these years, that there are certain instances where there would be better professionals responding to certain type of situations, such as individuals with mental illness and other related situations. But this case will not go to the case where a parent calls the police officer. The police officer shows. A parent calls the police officer because her son is off his meds and he's naked in the street, and it just leads to bad situations. Those are major policy issues and decisions that are collateral at best as it relates to this case. I know in Ohio, where I live, our Supreme Court has been pretty specific. It's been very consistent about this issue that was presented to the court, and officers have that right. Is it a perfect system? No, it's not. But these type of issues where you have a warrantless search, you have many defenses to those warrantless searches, and if they are not, legitimate, you know, you're going to end up in a lawsuit. I know the issue of qualified immunity was thrown out there, and that's a subject that we've talked about before. But I think on this case, I'm not sure if all those issues that have been raised are germane or legitimate as to the court's issue. Whether the courts are old school or looking at the common law theory or not, I think it's going to sustain a conviction. And I think it should. Thank you.
Great. I wanted to give you this opportunity among yourselves if there are questions that you'd like to ask each other or areas of your previous remarks that you'd like to expand on. Please feel free to do so at this time.
This is Larry. I think it would be interesting for each of us, since we obviously have some very strong feelings about this case and what that outcome should look like, how would you decide it? From a policy standpoint, are you going to issue a blanket decision that prohibits misdemeanor pursuits into the home, or where are you going to draw the line? Because that's what the court's wrestling with. And I think that's what people are interested in. And I think that's what this case is really all about.
That's a great question. Dekron, you want to take a first crack at it?
Not really, but I will. I suppose it's really, really difficult. I don't envy the justices here. Part of me wants to say, look, just don't even try to draw a kind of categorical standard here and continue to do these on a case-by-case basis. The amicus arguing in defense of the lower court decision said, look, you are going to invite a flood of endless constitutional litigation if that happens. I don't know. To some extent, we already have a lot of that. I don't know that it could get much worse. That might be what I prefer. That was Mr. Lange's argument in the case today. I could maybe see an argument for allowing police officers to enter the home in a very small number of cases, and the distinction wouldn't be misdemeanor versus felony. Maybe it would be something like violent versus nonviolent, and also risk of evidence disappearing versus, you know, no risk of evidence disappearing. Those are some initial thoughts, but I'm not too married to any of that, to be honest with you. What do you guys think?
Would you, let me follow up on that. Would you put jail time, incarceration as the penalty as a consideration?
What do you mean by that, Larry?
Well, you remember, I can't remember what justice it was. He said, well, and I think he was talking about Massachusetts. He said the penalty for violating this statute is 11 months, and it wouldn't reach the 12-month threshold. You remember that exchange?
Yeah, I remember now. You know, I don't know if that's a workable standard to expect that members of law enforcement know all of the potential legal penalties that would attach to the thousands upon thousands upon thousands of crimes out there.
Right. And I think that's my point. So when you look at whether it's a misdemeanor or a felony, and that's why I don't think you can make that distinction, I thought when he started talking about jail time, that clearly went in the abyss. That's why I think they will not go down that rabbit hole.
Well, this is Clark. I mean, I think Larry's right that the court is likely to uphold the conviction in this case and come down relatively on the side of the government. And I'm not going to take a strong position that that's wrong, because I do think this is a very challenging case and probably a close call. That being said, I think that there is a tremendous amount at stake for the citizen when we allow armed agents of the state to enter the home by force without a determination on the part of, you know, an ostensibly neutral magistrate that whatever it is that they're after is sufficiently important, to overcome the sanctity of the home. I think, frankly, so there are about 13 million misdemeanor cases that are processed every year in this country. My own perception is that most of those are relatively trivial cases where society really doesn't have a great deal at stake. They're mostly about, most of those cases end up being resolved through the payment of a fine. I think a lot of this is about revenue raising. Not all of it, but a lot of it's about revenue raising. So my perception is that the state rarely has a great deal at stake in the pursuit of any particular misdemeanor. Of course, they will sometimes. Somebody who's, you know, driving drunk down the road certainly puts others at risk. So I'm not saying that it never happens. But on balance, I think the state generally has a relatively low interest in pursuing and apprehending the average misdemeanor immediately in the moment. Whereas I think there's a tremendous amount at stake for individuals who have reached the sanctity of their home in allowing police officers to enter the home by force and against the will of the people who live there. And so I would come down on the side of saying to the government, you know, if you really think it's that important, put your money where your mouth is. Go get a warrant. If you need to summon some additional officers to put a perimeter around the dwelling, then do that. But if it's not worth the trouble of getting a warrant, if it's not worth the trouble of hanging around until you have been given permission by a magistrate to enter the home and continue your business, then it seems like maybe there's not all that much at stake and you should just go on about your business. But, that's certainly my inner libertarian talking. I recognize that. And I think both as a matter of doctrine and just sort of realpolitik, it is likely that the court will come down in this case some distance away from my sort of personal preferences. And I don't even want to make the case I'm not making a strong case that I think the Constitution compels the result that I'm talking about, because there is a collision of some really, really challenging and conflicting values here. But I would prefer to see the court place relatively greater emphasis on the security interests of people inside the home and lesser interests or lesser weight on the interests of a state that has utterly trivialized the whole concept of crime and including misdemeanors and make the state put its money where its mouth is. If it really wants to apprehend somebody, it can wait a little bit until it gets a warrant.
This is Larry. One of the things that fascinated me about this case were the facts. I mean, so the officer puts his foot under the garage door and it goes back up. He enters. He has a conversation with the individual. He asks for his driver's license, his registration, and asks why he was playing the loud music, blah, blah, blah. The individual did not say, I assert my fifth right. You need to go get a warrant. I'm not leaving. The individual actually cooperated, stepped outside, and when he stepped outside is when the officer actually placed him under arrest. And I'm wondering if that narrow fact that no one talked about would have made a difference if the individual had not cooperated, had not stepped outside of his home. But I thought that was a little curveball that no one picked up on. So the decisions will probably come down. What's the usually about 6 months on this case, you think?
Yeah, I think it depends, honestly, on how many different justices end up writing. That tends to extend the time a bit. Of course, we expect the court's term to end in June, as it normally does. I'd be somewhat surprised if they ended up holding this case until the very end of the term. So I tend to expect to see a decision in this case more in the perhaps the April, May time frame. But again, if the justices end up all over the map, as they very well could, then it could be one of those cases we have to wait until the very end of the term.
You know, Justice Sotomayor seemed to have an idea, and she may end up kind of coaxing the court one way or another, because I think she was the most definitive of the justices in offering up what she thought might be a solution. But again, I think she was siding with California and giving law enforcement the discretion to pursue certain things with certain limitations.
Whenever the case comes out, one thing that I think will be fun is that I really doubt that this outcome is going to fall along traditional partisan lines. The criminal law cases sometimes can be scrambled in ways that that surprise people. And I suspect this case will be the same way. I could, for example, maybe imagine Sotomayor and Gorsuch being on the same side of the case.
Yeah, I agree. I agree on that. It was interesting. Thomas was very active. He did not pass on any question and presented, and he seemed to be stuck in the common law theories and what guidance we could take from that.
Any port in a storm, I suppose.
All right. Thank you very much for this discussion. We are approaching the hour, so I want to give you an opportunity to just make a closing remark before we close.
Same order?
Sure, same order.
Well, all right. Okay, if we go in the same order, then I'll go first and just say that it's a difficult case. It's a challenging case. I'm not sure how they're going to decide it. I'm not sure that I know how they should decide it, but I think that the broader policy issue that emerged from the case was about overcriminalization. And just the enormous number of criminal laws in the books. And whatever the court does here, I think that legislatures and Congress need to step up and reverse the overcriminalization problem.
Mrs. Clark, I agree, no surprise. I want to emphasize a theme that I've noted several times throughout the conversation, and that is that I do think that there is an increasing gap between the justices on the one hand and the general public on the other in terms of sort of the perception of where things stand with law enforcement. I think that the court has been quite protective of the prerogatives of government and particularly of law enforcement when it comes to their interactions with citizens. My sense is that is now increasingly out of step with what ordinary people perceive and desire and understand what our Constitution guarantees them in terms of its protections is an extraordinarily difficult issue to fine tune and to get right. But I think it matters tremendously that, you know, in these close calls or these cases that represent a close call, that the justices at least have an accurate perception of you know, how the general public is moving. It doesn't mean that dictates the outcome, but I think it should at least be a factor in how the court assesses the various competing dynamics that we discussed in this case and the weight that it gives to the interests on both sides. And they are significant interests. The state certainly has an interest in enforcing its own laws and having its authority respected. People, of course, have a strong interest in their own safety and the security of the home in which they live.
This is Larry. Lastly, I don't disagree that we need to revisit some of our laws, and we've seen that in the marijuana area and the decriminalization around the country on that point. But I would hope equally concerned with everyone is the peculiar situation that law enforcement finds itself. If the laws are on the book and the officers are to observe and the officers are to decide what laws to enforce and what laws not to enforce, they're going to find themselves administratively disciplined from time to time. So if you're going to fault law enforcement, understand that this is not the bed that they made. This is the bed that they've inherited, and they are required by law to enforce those. If a speed limit's X, and you know someone's going 1 mile over or 5 miles over, 20 miles over, you know, let's articulate and say these are the rules. And if the rules are on the book, when we look at the situation that came out of Minneapolis, that provision technique had been on the books for 20 years. I'm not justifying it. I think it was a horrible situation. I would have audited. I would have had those laws and those techniques off the books. But law enforcement finds itself, you know, you talk about an arcane situation where justices might find themselves. This is law enforcement realities, the do's and don'ts and the consequences of those. And I think that's grossly unfair. Thank you, everyone. I appreciate having the opportunity to be a part of this program.
Hey, this is Nick from FedSoc. Thanks all for joining. On behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank you for the benefit of your valuable time and expertise this afternoon. Also to our audience for calling in and your good questions. Just a reminder, keep an eye on your emails and our website for announcements about upcoming Teleforum calls and Zoom events that you can register for. We've got one coming up tomorrow, a couple events actually. So check out the website for more information about those. And with that, thank you all for being with us this afternoon. We are now adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Teleform, a podcast of the Federalist Society's practice groups. For more information about the Federalist Society, the practice groups, and to become a Federalist Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.